to. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And for the hour, we're going to be talking to songwriter and singer John Paul White, a real talent. And you're listening to the song Poison and Wine, which propelled the Civil Wars. He was a lead singer. It was a duo, actually. And this song propelled them to the top of the charts and to Grammy territory. Let's take a listen. Joined by John Paul White, and we're joined because his new album, Beulah, is in record stores everywhere. We always start off all of our interviews real simply, and that is, where were you born, and who are your parents, and how did both of those things impact who you are and what you're doing today?
I was born in Tuscumbia, Alabama, at Helen Keller Hospital. I was not Helen Keller Hospital at the time. It was Colbert County Hospital, but it changed names later. And yes, that Helen Keller. Ivy Green is just down the street where she learned how to sign water. You can still go there today. I was born to Mac and Mary White, and they actually grew up on the Tennessee state line on the Tennessee side. So we were living down there when I was born, and before I started school, they moved up to the Tennessee state line back to where their roots were, which was about 20 miles north of the Shoals. And I, lived there until after high school and moved back to the Shoals at that point. But my dad was a farmer, a chicken farmer, and my mom was a laborer on that farm. She probably, worked as hard as any woman I ever met. And so my formative years were all out there on 30 acres, taking care of poultry and living out in the middle of nowhere in rural Tennessee. And it was a pretty blissful existence. My dad had worked for Ford Motor Company in the Shoals, and then it shut down and put a whole lot of people out of work. And so we subsisted solely on that farm for quite a while until he found work again. And you couldn't have told us any different, that life was any different for anybody else, because we were miles from the next family, went to a little small church-run private school, and everybody else was in the exact same boat as we were, so there was never any sort of class or social status. We were all just all struggling equally, and it was a really good childhood, to be honest.
Yep, and it's something I experienced. I grew up, John, in the New York area, but on my first tour with my dad and I would drive around the country together alone and spend some time visiting Civil War sites and battlefields, but that wasn't what we were really doing. We were going out and seeing our country. And something struck me about the way people in the South, and particularly the rural South, lived. And it had nothing to do, John, with the picture I had in my head from the movies I saw and the imagery I saw, particularly how white and black people lived together, particularly how just kind and warm Southern people were. And I think so much of the simple nature of their lives, and I don't mean that they were simple people, but that the lives were sort of stripped down, and life became actually quite pleasant for so many people. Talk about that. And you've been around the block, so you're a guy who grew up like that, but has also been around big cities, could live anywhere you want to live in the world. And where do you live now?
I live right there in Florence, Alabama, right there where I was born. And I have no intentions of going anywhere else. I'm able to, you know, take care of my wanderlust by doing the touring thing. I get to visit lots of great cities and eat lots of great food and meet lots of great people. But, you know, every single experience cements my belief that, you know, the Shoals, the Tennessee Valley is where I was always meant to be and where I'm meant to stay. And, you know, I've got small kids and a beautiful wife, and I'm gone a lot. And so it makes a lot more sense for them to have a support network close by, a lot of family close by, and low crime rate, and, you know, cost of living is low. And,
yep.
And just it's a really good existence. But, you know, you made a good point about how, you know, things really were just boiled down to their very simplest structure growing up in the South when I did. You know, pre-cable, pre-internet, pre-cell phones, pre-all that stuff. And, you know, I'll be one of those old fuddy-duddies that, you know, miss the old days. I wish my kids could grow up in that existence. And you know, we try to keep that sort of mentality going in our house. We try to not be too connected and be aware of the world within your reach, and not, I think both worlds can coexist if you do it judiciously. But, I miss those days of having so much less distractions and having more laser focus on what was going on right in front of you.
And when we come back, more from John Paul White, his new record, Beulah. Go to Amazon and get it. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories.
Ice, water, drink it down till it's gone. I saw her, drink it down till it's gone. Oh, well, there's always a second time around. So bitter in my heart and in my
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and you're listening to John Paul White's What So, a terrific new song on his new album, Beulah. John Paul's recording his first solo record in many years, and it's great.
Oh, in the road, sun on your back, shoulder the load your ancestors had, wear on your sleeve the virtues you lack, but don't get above your race.
And now we're rejoined by John Paul White, and we love talking about location. You draw a line around Memphis and go out 300 miles, John, and it's almost all of American music. It's crazy.
Yeah.
What is it about the soil?
That's definitely true.
What is it about the soil? What do you think? Have you thought about it? Have you pondered it?
I have a bit, you know. I'm asked that question. Obviously, being from one of those centers, I am definitely asked that question. What's in the water? What's the deal? Why is there so many people? And even to this day, you know, with Gary Nichols of Steel Drivers and Jason Isbell and Alabama Shakes, Anderson East, and, you know, Dylan LeBlanc. There's so many artists doing it and doing it well. I think, you know, some of us nowadays are standing on the shoulders of the guys that came before us.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd be perfectly fine with saying that, but obviously, how did they make it happen? How did that come about? I think, you know, Spooner Oldham and I have talked about this, and Spooner is a legendary session player from back in the day, and till today, he still plays on sessions for us at Single Lock Records, our little label back home. And he, you know, he... he demystifies it. He doesn't think that there's anything in the water. And, you know, he kind of shrugs when people say that.
But, yep.
And I guess I do, too. I'd love to be a romantic about it and say there's something spiritual there and that it's in the water. And that feels good. And who could say? But I will say that, my take has always been that, and this is obviously not exclusive to the South or to the Shoals, but for whatever reason, there was this perfect alignment of poverty, a little bit of ignorance and not in a, non-intelligent kind of way, but, people like Rick Hall that came along and had nothing but had all the drive in the world and could not be told, you can't start a studio in the middle of nowhere. You can't cut hits in the middle of nowhere. You can't have a record label in the middle of nowhere. And he had just enough cojones to tell people, just watch me.
Yep.
Watch me do this.
Yep.
And he was smart enough to sense great talent around him when he saw it and exploit the heck out of it. And he'd be the first to tell you. And the thing that really put us on the map was when people like Jerry Wexler at Atlantic up in New York
yep.
took a notion. When he saw, Rick deserves the credit for cutting, You Better Move On and things like that, Jimmy Hughes and Steal Away and stuff like that.
Yep.
But he got Jerry's ear, and then Jerry started sending Wilson and Aretha and Clarence Carter and all this stuff started coming down. There should be a huge statue to Wexler in my town. And, one of these days there will be because he's still revered by all those guys. But you take that, you take some of the Stax stuff coming over, you take some of the Motown stuff coming down, and then it just exploded. But it was a bunch of funky white dudes that didn't know any better that they couldn't do it.
Yep.
They just said, well, why can't we?
Yep.
Let's just tackle it and see what happens.
Yeah, the kind of ignorance that almost borders on innocence, in a sense.
Yeah.
I didn't know. I couldn't not know.
Innocence is probably a better word, but that's definitely the truth. But all of those guys came from the same walk of life, and none of them had any money. None of them had any prospect for any money. None of them had any training. They were not skilled musicians. They just played what they felt. They played what they saw at the local club. They played what they heard on on the Otis Redding records or even earlier records than that, and just made it up as they went.
Yeah, and Jerry Wexler, I think what's most interesting about him, and here's a Jewish record producer from the biggest, the most powerful music city in the country, I would guess at the time. L.A. had not yet sort of metastasized as another center of music, and Nashville still wasn't quite, it had one idiom, it had country, but here's
sure.
New York City. And Jerry Wexler did not suffer from what lots of people suffered from at the time, which I believe was regional bigotry. That is that a lot of Americans have a vision of the South, that nothing good could come from there, and that this man had the vision to say, wow, these swampers, listen to this. What is this?
Man.
I'm curious. And he had that curiosity and innocence himself, I think, John.
I couldn't agree with you more. And his mentality, his personality, and the way that he looked at music and the world around him matched up perfectly with the guys in the Shoals, because people like Rick and David Hood and Jimmy Johnson, it can't be overstated, the racial equality that is depicted in that film.
Yep.
Because it wasn't because, I won't even pretend that it was because these guys were better people
right.
than anyone else in the South or anyone else in the world. They were very practical, guys, and they were like, who's the best drummer?
Yep.
I don't care what the color of the skin is. Who's the best drummer and is going to help me cut a hit? Well, then you're the drummer. Who's the best singer? Well, then you're the singer. There was absolutely no qualms at all about ethnicity. And Jerry, I think Jerry looked at the world the same way. It was like, where's the next hit?
Yeah.
Where's the next big thing? What's going to move me? And he wasn't afraid to go to it. He didn't have to have it come to him. And it was a perfect marriage, man.
Yeah.
As I said, he probably was the catalyst.
Let's talk about you and your music. I think folks know you from the Civil Wars, and a Grammy Award-winning a duet, a writing powerhouse that, you know, I when I first heard Poison and Wine, my wife had sent it to me, and she was crying when she heard it, John. And I give you and pay you the highest tribute, because I think if you can make someone cry, it's and I think we all need to cry regularly. It's a beautiful thing. And talk about what it was like, Ada, to be in a group like that, and then ultimately you're now making your first solo record in 8 years. Talk about the Civil Wars, that success, and then that journey to being that solo artist you are now.
Sure. Well, I won't even pretend that I had any clue whatsoever that the Civil Wars would be as successful as it was. And to be honest, you know, you mentioned it's been 8 years since I made a solo record. Once I made that solo record, it was for Capitol Records, and about the time I was mixing that record, the label imploded. They merged Capitol with Virgin, and the head of Virgin became the head of all of it. So all the Virgin acts, they survived, and all the Capitol acts that didn't have their record already out, we got cut. So I was in a really bitter place at that time. And so when the Civil Wars happened, I had a completely different mentality than I had any of the years prior, whereas I was just making music to please myself. I'd done it the other way around. I had tried to play the game and just came out of it really bitter and decided I'm only going to make music that makes me happy, because at the end of the day, it is a crapshoot whether anybody else is going to connect with this.
Yep.
You know, I can't control that at all. All I know is whether I like it. And if I stick to that criteria, I've got to hope that there's a lot of other people out there in the world that like the same things that I do.
Yep.
And that's, I fearlessly, selfishly started making music that way once I met Joy and we started the Civil Wars. And so I won't even pretend that I saw that connection happens so fast with fans, with the public at large, and it kept stair-stepping so quickly and escalating so fast, and it was a whirlwind. And it's kind of hard to remember a lot of it, because it was I had blinders on. Just okay, tell me where I need to be at this moment, and I will give you all I've got at this moment, and then tell me where I need to be right after that. And it was at times there was bliss to it, you know, that I could just focus on making music. But it was also very, you know, overwhelming, and you know, there was lots of things that were just sliding right past that I just had to trust other people to deal with. And so I wasn't super hands on after a certain amount of time, because it was just literally impossible. We were basically the record label the entire time, so all the responsibility was in our laps. So I just worked as much and as often as humanly possible.
And this is Lee Habib. We're talking to John Paul White and his new album, Beulah. It's available everywhere. Go to Amazon, buy it. And when we come back, we're going to dig into the record, more about John Paul White's life. This is Our American Stories. Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And for the hour, we're talking to John Paul White, singer, songwriter, and at one point, the Grammy Award winner with the Civil Wars. And it's a tough journey to go from that and going back to that solo career, but it's something that John Paul White was dedicated and determined to do. It was an artistic choice that he decided to make. John, let's carry on with that idea of moving from this very successful duo, but you wanting to just, well, do something else.
I learned a lot during that process, where you know, again, getting back to what we were talking about what really is important and what is not, and what is something that I'm willing to fight for and strive for, and what, you know, really isn't a priority for me anymore. And so I've gotten to do a lot of things that I wanted to do, a lot of bucket list items. And I'm at a place now that my one and only priority is, you know, being happy. And being happy is making music that I really dearly love, going and playing it for people, which I did not realize would be something that made me happy again, because I was so burnt out from so much touring.
Yep.
But I'm thoroughly enjoying myself playing these songs for people. And making sure I don't go too much, make sure I don't leave too often, making sure that my first and, you know, that my main priority is my family and my well-being and my health and my future.
When I sense this in the new record, Beulah, and I want to talk about that word, John, because it means a lot of things to a lot of people. I mean, I looked it up,
yes.
and my goodness, and I love a word like that. And I think your writing is very much like that. One of the things I promise I will not ask you during this interview is, what does a song mean? It's the worst thing to ask a writer, and I wouldn't do that to you. It's whatever we think it should mean. And my sister's a writer, and what do you think it means? I think is the only answer that matters. What does the audience think it means? But you pick these subjects to write about that have this sort of, they're not on the nose. And they give space for people to lean into the song. And yet there's a structure there. But the word Beulah, why that word?
Beulah is, it has many different levels of meaning for me. The first, the primary reason that word is even a part of my lexicon is because of my family. My dad used to call my little sister that as a term of endearment. I call my daughter that. I call my wife that. It's a word that's always been around in that kind of context. And it's also, you know, my mom's Catholic, but my dad was, Southern Baptist. And, you know, the gospel songbook was a big part of their lives. And songs about Beulah Land were common.
Yep.
Because it's a biblical term, although I think it's only mentioned once in the Bible, but it's definitely a common word in the South, in gospel songs. But for me, the larger meaning of it comes from a guy named William Blake, and I don't pretend to be the most well-read, intelligent guy, but and especially in the world of philosophy, but he's a guy that I dig, you know, a lot of what he's written. And I read, you know, Milton back in high school, and it kind of stuck with me. But he has his own little mythology for the way the world works. And his phrase, he used the term Beulah for a place that you could go to, either through meditation or, you know, whatever. You could go there and you could center, you could heal, get it together, you know, and escape from the world until you straighten out all the things that need to be straightened out. And you couldn't stay there. You know, it was a temporary harbor.
Yep.
But when you came back to the world, you came back a little bit more whole, a little bit more prioritized. I felt like there's no better word that sums up this record.
Oh, that's wonderful. Let's talk about a couple of the songs. Let's talk about What's So, because I watched it up on Rolling Stone's website and listened to it. And sometimes I get distracted when I watch a video because it has nothing to do with the song, or it gets in the way of the song. I love the way you did the video. I love the way you shot it. It was just simple. It served the song. It didn't get in the way of the song. And let's take a listen.
Sun on your back, shoulder the load your ancestors had. Wear on your sleeve the virtues you lack, but don't get above your raising.
Talk about some of the things you're getting at in that song, because I've always been around now in my life folks who are really aware of their station in life. And talk about that, and talk about folks who are in these spaces, love these spaces, because I think you're writing about, in some respects, some of those things. And it's also, it feels like just a look back. Talk about the song.
You know, we've kind of touched on some of those thoughts earlier with, you know, being from Loretta, Tennessee community, which is mostly farmers, carpenters, you know, tradesmen, you know, a lot of blue collar, if even that. And, you know, we all had a common bond in that we all really didn't have a lot. And the only people that really got ostracized, that got pushed around, were the kids that had it all. The kids that came in with the new toys and the new clothes and the new TV, and they had a TV in their room or anything like that. If anybody ever brought that stuff up, they got bullied. They got, you know, completely ignored, because it was, you know, it was the opposite way that it probably is more so nowadays. And so materialism, we would have loved to have had all that stuff. It's not because we were better kids, but it's just like that was not an option. So, you know, elevating your stature relative to the people around you, that was always frowned upon. And I remember that heavily. My dad saying, you know, don't put on airs.
Yep.
You know, don't get above your raisin. Don't. You know, who's this guy think he is? You know, I know him.
Right.
He picked cotton right alongside me his whole childhood. Why does he think he's better than us, you know, just because he went to college? You know, I heard all those conversations, and I took it to heart.
Yep.
Whether it's the way it should be or it shouldn't be, it's a big part of my childhood, and it's a big part of growing up as a male in the South, is that we're all working the same row, and some of us are a little more successful than others, but that doesn't make you any different as a human being.
Yeah, I always tell people, so what? You're a little more successful. Yeah. So what? Now what?
Yeah, I battle with it a lot. You know, with varying successes that I've had in life, it's always been with an all shucks kind of mentality. You know, even to the point of, you know, frustrating people. Like, why don't you just accept the good things that have happened for you and be proud of those. And I do in my own way, but there's always just a little tinge of I don't know, a little bit of that Catholic guilt seeps in there or something. Like, why are these things happening for me? Because I know people more talented. I know people that work harder. I know people that are more deserving.
Right.
And so everything is with a grain of salt. And I think I needed to write that song to express that, not only to articulate it for myself, but to people around me and people from my hometown, that, you know, I'm still that same guy.
Yeah. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. John Paul White for the hour. His new record, Beulah. Pick it up at Amazon.com. And what's new? Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. We've been talking to John Paul White for the hour, and we love talking to artists and talking about artists. John Paul White, Make You Cry. Talk about that song.
Well, it's, you know, as you said earlier, I'm not very good with meanings of songs, because sometimes I know what they're about, sometimes I don't, but most often, my old mentor, his name was Walt Aldridge, and he's written some two or three songs of the year in the country world back in the day, and a brilliant songwriter. And I remember writing songs for him, and he would tell me, he said, "Don't put a ring in the song." And what he meant was, he explained that you put a wedding ring on anybody's finger in the song, you have just completely left a lot of the population out of the song. They can't live inside it. They can't live vicariously through it and yep. become a character because they're not married. And
right.
so they don't have that point of view. And I really took that to heart. So I've always tried to make sure that songs had a little gray, a little vague quality to it so that anybody can step inside it. So that's, you know, a lot of what I do, that happens. And so it, what I think it's about is not anything like what other people think it's about. And a lot of times what they think it's about is much better.
Right.
And I just like to take credit for that. But with that song, it's, you know, it's one of those universal things that we all want to be missed. We all want to be cared about, whatever the situation is that has two people be apart, you know, whether you wanted it, whether they wanted it, whatever, you still want there to be a little pang there. You still want there to be a little twist of the knife, no matter what.
Yep.
And so I feel like I'm always trying to touch on universal truths, things that affect everyone. And I still feel like those things are still out there that haven't been written about. And I really wanted to dig into that self-loathing, that self-reverence of, you know, yeah, I still need to be needed.
Yep. And it's a universal cry, ultimately. And I would
think so.
Yeah. And I want to talk about one other song. It's not on the record, but it's my wife's favorite song from a series called Nashville, which has terrific writing in it. And Buddy Miller's sitting there, and, you know, you've got T-Bone Burnett being the musical director. And when I saw those names, I said, whether I like the plot, whether I like the acting, I got to watch this series just so I can hear the songwriting. And No One Will Ever Love You. And by the way, when you performed it, I did not know you had written that song. And I wish you'd record it, because, my goodness, I love Connie Britton, and I love the team that sang it. But, my goodness, John, you kill that song.
Well, thank you very much, man. I appreciate that. That song has been around for a while. I wrote that with Steve McEwen, who's a guy that from London, and I wrote that with no intention of anything Nashville-related actually connecting with it and using it and actually getting a cut. We were just selfishly writing a song that made us both happy. And I have to give credit to T-Bone Burnett for that, because when he asked me, he said, I'm working on this new show. Do you have anything that you're really proud of and happy with that hasn't been used, that's exclusive? And thought, well, here's a chance for me to show T-Bone a song that I'm really proud of, and maybe it will spur further collaboration. So I honestly never imagined that he'd be able to use it in a show about Nashville, Tennessee. But, you know, to his credit, he pulled it off, and I'm really proud of that.
Great. And I'll leave you with this, because we like to play it, and it's Martin Scorsese, and he's talking about movies. But my sister's a writer, and I have so many friends who are musicians, and I don't know why, but people would always say, why do you want to do that? That's not real life. And how silly to want to be a writer and the like. And so I wanted to have you listen to Martin Scorsese talking to folks at the Kennedy Center about what movies were to him and to us, and in the end, what storytelling and art is to all of us.
Whenever I hear people dismiss movies as fantasy, I make a hard distinction between film and life. I think to myself that it's just a way of avoiding the power of cinema. I mean, of course it's not life. It's the invocation of life. It's an ongoing dialogue with life. Frank Capra said, film is a disease. He went on, but that's enough for now.
And so it sounds to me like, hey, you've caught the disease. I know songwriters. They're, in the end, because of the task at hand, I found them to be not dour, but just they're always in a place because they always have this struggle, and it's a good struggle. And yet, what I think Scorsese said about art being the invocation of life and an ongoing dialogue, we rely on the writers, and in the end, we Americans and people of the world, for you to help us with that dialogue, and that's a heck of a burden.
Well, it is that. I definitely have realized that when I write things, that whether they pertain to my life or to some sort of obvious parallel with my life, or if I go straight to, using that word fantasy, if I just pull things completely diametrically opposed to the way that I've always lived, I have realized that if I do it in a way that is honest and that is heartfelt and that I'm really being mindful of portraying all the characters in the most true light, I've noticed that the way it connects with other people is it's mind-boggling, because as I said, if I keep the edges gray, the stories that people tell me about how this song meant this to me because this happened to me, and when you hear it from that context, you realize, wow, I couldn't have written that song if I knew their story.
Right.
It would have skewed what I did. So I feel like, all of us have that power and that burden to be able to be a voice for other people that could never, articulate what was going on in their lives because they either didn't have that skill set or they just couldn't put it into words. It was too close. It was too,
yep.
It would be too maudlin if they were in the middle of it trying to write a song about it. So I don't clearly understand why I'm able to do that, and any of us as songwriters are able to do that, but I try not to overanalyze it and just let it happen.
John Paul White, the record is Beulah. Pick it up on Amazon, maybe even pick it up at an actual store. And go to OurAmericaNetwork.org to catch and listen to all of our discussions with so many of the great artists, songwriters, actors, and directors that we so love in our country.
I want to fight for you.
And this is Our American Stories, and as you know now, there's no hot political talk here. You're going to have to go somewhere else. It's stories and only stories here on Our American Stories, and we love music. You heard our hour on Robert Plant, his two trips to America, the Delta Blues first, and then Nashville and beyond, getting back in touch with his roots, gospel songs and Americana. And today, we're getting into and digging into the life of an American music producer, and we brought a few of those lies to you as well, Rick Rubens. And now someone who I think is, and I think he's going to almost blush when we say this, but I think it's true, joining the ranks of Rick with some of the artists. I know, oh no, I hate doing that to you. But it's Dave Cobb, who we read about in the Wall Street Journal. I'm a big music fan, so I've known Dave's work and been following the artists he's been getting behind and just getting the best out of, which I think is what producers or great directors do, is they get the best performance out of an artist. And actually, it's what coaches do in the end. And we love talking about coaches, John Wooden and Coach Krzyzewski. And it's all about pulling the God-given talent out of and the potential out of a human being. And Dave Cobb, your artist, Chris Stapleton, Jason Isbell, Sturgill Simpson, Lake Street Drive. And thanks for joining us.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it, man. Too nice.
Hey, you bet. And hey, look, before we start, we always like to talk to everybody on our show about their life, about their childhood in particular, and how it shaped who you are and what you do. Talk about that, if you could, with us, Dave.
Well, I grew up, I'm from Savannah, Georgia, and I grew up in Pentecostal church. My grandmother was a minister, so we always had, in our church, we did pretty much hymnal-based music and, you know, pedal steel, piano, guitar, and bass, and, you know, kind of a choir singing the whole time. And you know, when I was a kid, I was into Black Sabbath and AC/DC and Van Halen and Led Zeppelin and pretty much anything but how I grew up. And I had to move to California and really learn about country music way late in life and to kind of discover where you came from in the first place, you know?
You bet. So you bet. And you actually moved away from the South. Talk about that.
I did at 27. At 27, I moved. I was in a band, and my band's record deal was kind of getting stuck, and I felt like, you know, I really felt a calling to be in the studio, and I felt like California was a place to go, so I ran all the way to California to produce rock records. And when I got out to California at 27, I met Sheeter Jennings, Waylon Jennings' son, and we produced his first record, and that wound up being my first hit country record. And next thing you know, through him, I met Jamie Johnson and was starting to, I did a couple songs in his first record, about seven on the second record, and just kind of kept coming to Nashville after that. So eventually I kind of really discovered great country music through the Jennings, you know. It was really him educating me, playing me the right records, and then I discovered all the stuff I didn't know about growing up, you know.
And talk about some of those right records. Talk about some of the music you may have passed over when you were young, but as you got older you went, my goodness, this is really good.
Well, the gateway record for me was this concept record called White Mansions that an English guy, Paul Kennelly, wrote about the American Civil War. And it had Gwyn Johns, my favorite English producer, produce the record. And he had Waylon Jennings and Jesse Coulter. And when I heard that record, it was my gateway into country music, which was really kind of a back way to get into it. And then I discovered, you know, how great Waylon was. And I started buying every Waylon record I could, and I discovered all the offshoots of that. Everybody else, all his contemporaries, you know, Jerry Reed, and started diving into everything with that, and, you know, Glenn Campbell, and started going crazy on Glenn Campbell, and just I kept kind of digging and digging and digging, and then, you know, it's been, you know, kind of like a rebirth musically to hear all these great country records that I never knew about. I mean, in our house we had, you know, the poppiest of the pop country records that we had. I mean, it was a Barbara Mandrell record or Kenny Rogers, but I didn't know about Johnny Paycheck, you know?
Right.
So it's or even Marty Robbins, you know, so it's continual learning for me. It's kind of this huge wealth of music that I'm still digging into, and I'm always excited about. You know,
what struck me about country, as you can tell from my accent, we broadcast here from Oxford, Mississippi, but I grew up in New Jersey, northern New Jersey, right by New York City, and I was a huge Springsteen fan. And when he started dipping into the river, when he started dipping into Drive All Night, and he was trying desperately in Nebraska, I think, to become a country artist, to become Johnny Cash almost.
You hear it clear as day he's in the country. You know, you hear it. You can tell he was a big Christopherson fan.
You bet.
You just hear it in the lyrics. And yeah, he's digging from the same well, that classic American music, you know, whether it be country or roots or whatever you want to call it. He definitely knew what was going on.
No, the first time folks heard him at the Beacon Theater come out alone, and I don't know what compelled him to do this. I think he just needed to shed the band and say, I want folks to hear my songs, and I wanted to hear the character-driven nature of the narratives, because I don't think a lot of people had understood that so many of his songs were driven by the narrative of a character that he was playing in the song, which is a true country, a real true in country tradition. Talk about that, if you could.
Well, you know, I think with country, it all begins with a song. I mean, it's always less about the track than it is the lyrics themselves. The lyrics are always number one. But I think maybe country has the highest regard, you know, with lyrics. I mean, you know, rock and roll, you can go, I want to rock and roll all night, party every day, and people love it and they feel it. But country, you got to have a derivative, you got to have a narrative, you know. It's more about the narrative than it is about the party. And, you know, maybe they party in it too, but there's definitely a story. There's always a link. And I think the songcraft is very high. It's very high form songcraft. So, you know, there are great country songs that take you a while to digest and figure out all the lyrics. So, you know, I think maybe as I'm getting older, I love country music more and more because I need more than just a melody. I need it all, you know, at this point.
Yeah, and obviously the music then serves the song rather than the other way around, and that's a very different thing than listening to a Zeppelin song where the lyric's important, but clearly the track is what snaps you into the world of Led Zeppelin.
Oh, absolutely. You think about Led Zeppelin, you think of, you know, any hit, you know, you think of the guitar riff first, you know what I mean?
Oh, I get it. And Dave, hold the thought. We're coming up against a break. We're talking to Dave Cobb, producer extraordinaire. I know he's just, he can't handle me saying that. He's humble, he's working with great artists, and he always wants to throw the credit on them, but my goodness, they speak highly of him. When we come back, more about Dave's life, and then the art of being a producer, here on Our American Stories. We'll be back after these messages.
Throwing shadows in the dark, and the memories keep on turning to the rhythm of a broken heart. You only need a roof when it's raining. You only need a fire when it's cold. And you don't know who I am. Most of you could care less, and the rest don't give a damn. Your accent's fresh, you'll know just when you take a look at me. I'm everything you've ever been, ever wanna be. My game is the winner take all. I live on the edges, so I'm subject to a fall. I ain't never been a loser, I ain't never gonna be. I'm like running in the rain. You don't mess around with me.
This is Lee Habib, and we're listening to Waylon Jennings, and we did that because, well, Dave Cobb said it was Waylon who took him back to the music he loved or knew when he was a kid, or actually didn't know. He knew pop country, but he didn't know this country, what I like to call real roots country. And Americana is what some people call it. And now let's pick up where we left off. How do you get into the world of being a producer? What led you to that space as opposed to being the player or being the writer? And what do you bring? What is the talent you bring to the equation that artists say, I got to work with Cobb?
Well, first of all, I think you lie your way into it, because I don't know if there's a producer school,
right?
You know? I don't know. I was in bands and we worked with producers and I watched them work and I thought, man, that's the life, you know? You get to kind of, it's basically a director of music, you know? You help pick the songs, you help, you're kind of a friend, a therapist, you know, you're an encourager, you know? And sometimes, some instances, you're the writer, you know, you're an artist with them, or you're the musician on the record. So there's kind of a lot of hats, and it really changes every single project. You know, there's no set in stone method for my job. It's kind of, you learn as you go and make it up as you go. But yeah, it's hard for people to understand what a producer is. And I really honestly don't understand either.
Good. And then hopefully you never figure it out. I think that's the key, because then you'll start probably having a cookie cutter approach, which I think is the death of art. And the death of a great production mind. I know it's true in acting and directing. Start repeating yourself.
Agreed.
It's over.
Yeah, I agree. Well, I don't think one suit fits all either. You know, everything's got to change. Everything's got to evolve. And you know, me personally, I would get really bored if I went in there and copied every technique I used on every record. It wouldn't be a very fun job, and it would become work. I like for it to be this, you know, kid's imagination land where you walk in and everything's possible and there's no limits, and I don't like rules too much, you know.
Well, so this recently, you know, a couple of Grammys, Best Country Album, Chris Stapleton's The Traveler. It's just exquisite. It feels like a record. It feels like a record you always knew but never heard before. It feels like it's almost a part of the DNA of the culture already, and that's such a hard thing to stumble on. How did that record come to be? How did you get to know Chris?
Well, I was working with this band, Rival Sons, from California, and while I was living in Los Angeles, and they played me Steel Drivers, Chris Stapleton's previous band, through an iPhone, and man, it just shut me down. I mean, you just don't hear voices like that, you know? I'm always drawn to that, whether it be, you know, Greg Allman or Rod Stewart, the kind of raspy, you know, powerhouse kind of voice.
Yep.
And so, you know, he was on my radar then, and it took me years to actually get a chance to work with him. His manager called and said he wanted to meet. He'd heard Sturgill Simpson album and wanted to get together. So we got together and we pretty much talked about guitars and cars and just hit it off. And it felt like, you know, the same way you said that the record feels like a record you've always had or heard, I felt like he was a friend that I always had, you know. And so then we went in the studio and somehow the label was really amazing and let us go wild in the studio and really trusted us. And I think we started off, you know, let's cut six songs and see how it goes. And when the time we had booked for the six songs was done, we'd finished the whole record. And so the label came by and heard it and were completely supportive and just really, you know, it was an amazing time where it just felt like we were goofing off and having fun and we weren't working. It was just pure art and pure, you know, heart and soul into these days. And we came out with the record that you hear now.
You know, there's a piece or a part of the Wall Street Journal article that talked about your love of first takes and spur of the moment performances. And we had done an hour on Frank Sinatra. And it was interesting. Sinatra liked to go into the studio, we learned, from him himself, once, twice the most. And this is back when there were 70 or 80 set orchestras in a room, and they were union orchestras. And after that, he'd leave. He'd say, I don't want to do a fifth take. Or a six take. Talk about that.
Well, I think I can get away with that because of the caliber of these artists and their voices, you know, and their songwriting. You know, if I didn't have Chris Stapleton singing, it may take 50 takes and never be as good, you know.
Right.
Or Sturgill or Isbell or any of these people. I mean, they're really talented and they're really good. So I think I'm really fortunate to have worked with people that just already have a God-given talent. And you're right. And after you go back past a few takes with them, I mean, their mind's on to something else. They all have really active imaginations and have creative minds. So you got to capture it while they're really excited about it.
Yeah, capture
otherwise,
the spirit.
You
yep.
miss it, you know. So, but I do think I have a huge advantage because those guys are just so naturally talented. You know, they allow us to get away with doing one or two takes, you know.
You bet. You know, we were doing an hour on Cash, and we dug up some of the rare interview footage that we could, and archival footage of Cash talking to Ruben, and Ruben talking to Cash, and them talking about each other. And what was remarkable was the degree to which Cash trusted Ruben, and Ruben right. trusted Cash. And it just didn't sound like the hour we're getting ready for, which is George Martin, which was a very different kind of record producer. And it was much more technical, a lot of time in the studio. We're spending some particular time on Strawberry Fields and that entire Sgt. Pepper's record, which is a production piece and very intricate.
Yeah, well, George is one of my heroes for sure. I mean, you say it's a lot of time, but if you really think about how much time they took to make those records, it wasn't very long. You know, like the first Beatles records was done in a day.
Yeah.
You know, and the other ones weren't, you know, a couple weeks each and maybe a month. You know, it's really relative, you know, especially now people spend months on records.
So true.
Years on records, you know.
So true.
Even that was, I think George is every bit as applicable, you know, as maybe he's one of the best, he is probably the best producer in history. I mean, the guy came in, he was a musician, he was the A&R, he designed the group, he got creative with the band, he played on the records. He arranged strings on the records, so he kind of fits the bill as the ultimate producer, really.
Yeah, we dug up a great clip where it's McCartney talking about how he had written Yesterday, and he wanted to write it for the young girls. They had different audiences they tried to appeal to with their songs. And he said, George comes in and says, I hear strings on that. And he goes, we're a rock and roll band. George, we don't do strings. Well, he went back, did the arrangement, came back, and they fell in love with the orchestral arrangement to Yesterday. And I can't imagine the song without that arrangement, Dave.
Oh, I know. I mean, I think what was so great about George Martin is that he realized how to milk every single note and every single phrase out with emotion. I mean, he really knew how to work the emotion. And I think that's what a great producer does. He, when you hear McCartney sing that, you feel it. You just feel every ounce of it, you know. And I think that's what he does, you know, probably better than anybody who ever lived, you know.
Yeah. Let's talk about another example of your sort of no frills and spontaneous live-like production in the band you produce, Lake Street Drive. Tell us this story of what they're looking for and how you help them achieve it.
Well, I like Lake Street Drive because of Rachel. When I heard, obviously all of them are crazy talented and their musicianship is insane. That's the other reason I liked them. But she just had a voice. I always look for a voice in a singer, and she has just such a classic voice. She has one of those voices that are so familiar. It feels like, you know, a great you've never heard, but you feel like you've heard it your whole life. So that's what attracted me to them. But, you know, they were cut much the way Traveler was cut, all in one room, even the drums in the same room, the no headphones. And it was much like a Sinatra session, the same way you described that. It was Sinatra with the orchestra. Well, it was her with the band in one room and no headphones and just, you know, just an incredible talent, all of them. Everybody in that band is the highest degree of talent, you know, so that's what drew me to them. It was a blast, you know. It was nice to step into their world for a little while.
Well, when we come back, we'll talk to Dave about, well, music, more on the production front, and what's coming up in the future. And we'll go out with George Martin's Strawberry Fields and the Beatles. Strawberry Fields. More with Dave Cobb after this. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories.
Nothing is real, and nothing to get hung about. Strawberry Fields forever. No one I think is in my tree. I mean, it must be high or low. That is, you can't, you know, tune in. Thank you.
I was looking for a change of scene. You were looking at a magazine. It was red carpets and limousines. The grass seemed so much greener. All we wanted was to get there fast. So we packed up everything we had, running on hope and a tank of gas. Like dreams ain't just for dreamers. We couldn't wait to leave that life behind, trying to find salvation in that city limit sign. And one of those LA nights when the stars come out, oh, the stars come out and shine. And they burn so bright, they drown the downtown lights. When the stars come out, oh, when the stars come out.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we're talking with Dave Cobb. The Wall Street Journal profiled his work. We've been following it. We love music here on Our American Stories. And between Jason Isbell and Chris Stapleton, well, these are two of our favorite singer-songwriters coming up. You hear the bump music. That's Lucinda Williams. I don't think there's a better writer in the business. And wanted to pick up with the business of the business as we continue our conversation. Do you think something's happening? I mean, my sister's a professional writer. Her husband produced all kinds of big hip-hop records, Naughty by Nature and Queen Latifah's records. In the 90s and the 80s and the 70s, people both hated labels but loved labels. And then one day the labels sort of, at least for a lot of parts of the dimension of music, started to lose their influence with the sort of YouTubization of music and the downloads. But the A&R guy is just so important. And we did an hour on Ahmet Ertegun and what a life he had.
Yeah, one of my heroes, Atlantic, yeah. One of my heroes.
What is an artist without an A&R guy? I mean, and without a producer? I mean, how does the artist today, who's not hooked to or connected with someone who's going to develop them, give them the wingspan to fly, connect them with the great song if they're not writers? And in country, so often, we connect, you know, your job is to connect sometimes a song to an artist. Not always, but sometimes. Talk about the labels. What's happening now in the industry? Is there sort of a rebirth of the label?
I feel like it's a really good time with record labels. I mean, I have my own imprint with Elektra Records, and I got it because I sat with everybody at Atlantic in New York. Atlantic and Elektra, you know, are the same entity. And
yep.
I did a deal with them because they sat down and they want lifestyle art. They want to find these Springsteens or these artists at last, you know, that Aretha Franklin's, you know, Led Zeppelin's. They're more interested in the in kind of the art of music, and they think, you know, when you make these real honest records, they're going to outlive, you know, 2 second pop song. So I feel like there's a lot of that kind of opening up. I mean, Traveler was made for completely artistic purposes and it sold really well, so I think everybody's kind of looking, and so did Sturgill Simpson's Metamodern, and so did Jason Isbell Something More Than Free and Southeastern. So I think there's a wide open lane for artists in to coexist with major labels and indie labels. So, but I do think labels are great, you know, in a lot of ways, because you need support, you need help. You know, if you're the artist, you can't possibly worry about, you know, making sure you get all these contracts in and making sure you do all the press and get all the radio lined up, and it's just too much to handle. So I think they can be really helpful in that degree. And they can also, you know, be great in guiding you to somebody you didn't know. Maybe they hook you up with a producer that inspires the band to go a certain way or enhances the band. So I think we're at a good time with labels. Maybe we're back where it was in the early 70s, where Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin and all these artists were on major labels and had tons of success with it. So I think maybe we're back there when people are kind of gravitating towards something real and something tangible, and the sales numbers are there to support it. I think we have a good alignment with labels now.
Well, and I also think when you have a song like Cover Me Up by Jason Isbell, that's not going to become a number one song, but it's going to be the reason why you follow him down. You're going to follow him down to the ends of the earth, because he writes music that so deeply connects with you that when he plays it in concert, you can't hear a pin drop. People are moved. And I love concerts when they're still. And that's when you know you've done something really specific as a writer and a performer. Talk about that.
Well, I think, you know, when I did Southeastern with Isbell, I mean, I was such a huge fan of his prior. That's when I really started feeling the sea change. I mean, it just seemed like, you know, he did it through 30 Tigers on his own label, and people just came out for it. And I went to the shows, and it was the same thing. Like you said, you could hear a pin drop when he did those acoustic songs. Usually you got to go over to a show and bash people's faces off with loud up-tempo songs,
yep,
get the crowd going. But it was quite the opposite. I mean, when he played his acoustic song, everybody felt like it was a sacred moment and just observed and participated. And it was just this really beautiful moment in music that I think maybe he was the first artist to really kind of open this lane that seems to exist now. You know, I think he was a guy. I think when people on Music Row were writing about, you know, tailgates, he comes out and he writes about, you know, cancer and just makes everybody think twice lyrically. I think he raised the bar lyrically.
Yeah.
And I think he really did a lot of good for Nashville and, you know, songwriting in general.
No doubt. You know, we're about to feature a song. Every once in a while, we just get under the head of our hood of a song. And we did The Nick of Time last week. Bonnie Raitt had written about how that song came to be. And it's such the lyrics are just, and they're hers. She wrote that, as you know. And we love digging under a song, and we're about to be doing next week. A friend of mine sent me a link to Daryl Mobley sitting in an artist roundtable with Kenny Chesney, and Daryl sang and performed "There Goes My Life," and it's just it is just an unbelievable song. And from the very first lyric to the second to the third verse, you're stunned at the writing and the story it tells. Talk about you know, the discovery of a great song and what that's like.
I mean, it's funny. Isbell's a really great example. When we were doing Southeastern, when he came in with the song Elephant, I mean, when you hear him sing it, you just heard the song, and I didn't want anything around it. So I put him in my kitchen in my house. I didn't want anybody influencing him. I wanted you to hear the kind of purity of where the song came from. And as he was singing, it was coming through the speakers, and it felt like a classic record I'd never bought or heard. And it drew me in, and we all got, you know, chills, and it'd bring a tear to your eye, that the lyrics in that song. And so then after that, we added a couple overdubs to kind of fill it out. But that's one of those moments where, and somebody told me that, I think I stole this from Rick Rubin, you know it's right when it feels like a record.
Mm-hmm.
And some things feel like a great song, and some things feel good, but then sometimes you'll hear something come the first time, and it just feels like a record. And that song felt like a record that I'd never, you know, that I always had, but I couldn't place it. So, you know, I feel really fortunate to know people like Jason, because, you know, it makes it great when you walk in the studio and they have these songs done, you know. It makes my job real easy.
Oh, yeah, it does.
You know, I pretty much concentrate on where to order dinner at that point, you know.
Yep.
So, it's rare to hear these caliber songs, but thank God we have a few people out there that are doing it now.
And we do, and let's go out listening to Jason Isbell and the song that Dave Cobb was just talking about, Elephant.
Before she got sick, I'd never hear the end of it. She don't have the spirit for that now. We just drink our drinks and laugh out loud, bitch about the weekend crowd, and try to ignore elephant somehow. She said, "Andy, you crack me up. Seagrams in a coffee cup, sharecropper eyes and the hair almost all gone." She was drunk, she made cancer jokes, made up her own doctor's notes. Surrounded by her family, I saw that she was dying alone. But I'd sing her. Heart on the run, keeps a hand on the gun, you can't trust anyone. I was so sure when What I needed was more. Tried to shoot out the sun. Days when we raced, we flew off the page. Such damage was done. But I made it through, 'cause somebody knew I was meant for someone. So go leave your boots by the bed. We ain't leaving this room. But someone needs medical help or the magnolias. It's cold in this house and I ain't going out to chop. Cover me up, and know you're enough to use me for good.
This is Lee Habib, and you're listening to Jason Isbell, one of the artists that Dave Cobb produces, great singer-songwriter Chris Stapleton, and we're talking about music, the business of show business, and the radio and music business, and radio has been an integral part of this. They're pushing this music out of the pop country format. I never thought that would happen. And it is, and it's great. And Rick Rubin may have started it all with Deaf American, and then he's worked with Johnny Cash. You know, Rubin had said something interesting. He had said, well, he'd wanted to get Cash comfortable. He'd wanted to get him playing just the guitar while he sang again, just as he had done with Neil Diamond's. Just stunning. Rick Rubin, I mean, I'm not a big Neil Diamond fan. I can't take that record off the... out of the CD holder. It's just so damn good. And he said, I just don't want to mess it up. My job is to not mess it up and get the connection between the song and the performer in its purest form with these guys. Is there a piece of you that worries about messing it up with your artists? Ever?
Not really, because I think these people were in such alignment in personal taste, you know? And it is one of the things where I think the same way. I try not to mess it up. I try to find a way to the simplest path to making the song resonate and feel. So I don't worry about that too much. Actually, to be honest with you, I think when we go in the studio, we don't worry about a lot, but trying to, you know, make the artist sound like themselves and the best version of themselves. So
that's great.
I think if we do that, maybe we'll be all right.
I wanted to talk to you about two songs from Southern Family. The first titled You Are My Sunshine by Morgan Stapleton.
Yeah.
Talk about it and the why behind it. Why did you and Morgan choose this song? It seems like an obvious choice, but perhaps an overlooked one because of it. Talk about that song.
Well, I didn't choose the song. Morgan and Chris Stapleton chose the song, and they told me they wanted to do that song for Southern Family. When I told them about the impetus of the idea, and I kind of literally laughed at them. I said, come on, you're my sunshine. That's like the lowest, you know. It's like doing, you know, we wish you a Merry Christmas, you know, or Amazing Grace. It's something that is done a million times. And I play with them sometimes on guitar live, and they were doing a show, and I saw it in the set. Like, we're playing Sunshine tonight, and it's a G, just follow along with us. So I go up on stage, and they start playing it, and then they play it like they do on the record, and it just shut me down, and I had to apologize profusely. I mean, they reinvented the song. The only thing that's the same as the lyrics, really, and just the power those two have when they sing together is mesmerizing. And her voice, you know, on that song is so pure. And so I had to apologize. And I found out later that when they first got together, their first place had no furniture, and they picked up a guitar and they started singing that song pretty much the way it is now. So it's always meant something to them. It's their song. And Chris Stapleton actually has You Are My Sunshine on the inside of his wedding ring. So it's real personal to them. And it also kind of represents, you know, a song that every mother had sung to their child, you know, when they were children. So it's part of the fabric of American culture, I think, that song. So there's a lot of meanings to it. And I think the way they do it, they made it their own. They turned it upside down. And it's definitely just a real standout, you know, so powerful, so real. I'm in love with it, the way they did it.
Well, let's take a listen to what we pulled off of YouTube. Stapleton singing You Are My Sunshine.
Thank you. You make me happy when skies are gray. You'll never know, dear, how much I love you. Please don't say.
Dave, I guess that's what you mean by making a song their own, and thanks for sharing with us how that song came to be and the meaning and the personal meaning it had to them and what they taught you. You know, we were doing this hour on Robert Plant, and particularly his sort of resurgence with the Band of Joy, and there's this live BBC production. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but he performs with Buddy Miller and all these great Nashville cats, and the concert closes with him saying, I want to sing a song that I've always wanted to sing that says everything. And a cappella, he starts with that beautiful gospel nugget, I bid you good night. Then a few others join. Then a stage curtain pulls back, gospel choir, no musicians playing, just the vocals. And it stunned so many people when we played it that here's Robert Plant, the bad boy of rock and roll, returning to his roots and singing a gospel song of all things. Talk about that.
Well, that's where it all comes from, you know? I mean, I think Southern music, gospel, soul, country, bluegrass, folk, I think that's the birthplace of rock and roll. And obviously that's where he bit, you know, all his kind of influences from. So it makes perfect sense to me.
I mean,
it's kind of going back to the source about as far as you can go.
That's exactly what he had talked about. He had talked about, you know, at you know 31 or 32, John Bonham dies, there's Led Zeppelin. And he said, what am I going to do next? I don't want to be the head of a Led Zeppelin cover band. And he wandered,
yeah.
And then suddenly he links forces with Alison Krauss, and he says, this is what I need to do the rest of my life, is explore these deep roots, the roots that inspired me to play and sing music to begin with. You've taken over RCA Studio A. For folks who don't know about it, tell us about this place, David, as we close out, what it means to you, and how does it feel in any way to be a part of such a heritage?
I mean, RCA was built in 65, this specific studio, and they recorded Elvis Presley, they recorded Dolly Parton, Jolene was cut there, Waylon Jennings, all this, about, I think he did 11 records there, he did Daddy to Walk the Line there, and they did Eddie Arnold, Make the World Go Away. It's such a historic place, it's kind of like a temple that's been preserved, and it's just such a power. I think the Monkees recorded Daydream Believer there. I mean, half of my record collection growing up was recorded in this room, and it's been preserved, and it's one of the few studios that are around like it today. It's a massive place. I mean, it wouldn't even be financially feasible to build something like this now. But you walk in this place, and it's like a vintage guitar. It's got a song in it, and it's very inspiring. And we actually cut Chris Stapleton Traveler there, and we wanted to go there. Chris had the idea because it was going to be torn down. It was saved the last minute. But we thought we were the last people to record there, and it's such an amazing thing that it's still around. And now it's National Trust, so hopefully it'll be around forever. But yeah, it's a real powerful place to be in. It's incredible to have this opportunity to be there, and I'm very humbled by the opportunity to be there. So hopefully I don't mess the history of it up. Hopefully it keeps going, you know.
Well, it's in good hands, Dave, and we appreciate you joining us here in Our American Stories. Keep up the great work. Keep inspiring us. I think music does. You know, I think C.K. Chesterton had said, when we sing, we pray twice. And I think that's so true.
I like that. And I'm going to steal that. That's good.
it's all yours. And thanks so much for joining us, Dave.
Thanks so much. Y'all have a great day.
You take bet. Care. You take care. And I think the only thing to do after an interview like that is shut up and let the singer sing and the musicians play. And this is Chris Stapleton, Tennessee Whiskey, off his latest record.
Used to spend my nights out in barroom. Liquor was the only love I'd known.
but you rescued me from reaching for the bottom and brought me back, being too far gone. You're as smooth as Tennessee whiskey. For love in all the same old places.